Good evening, everyone. It's Sunday, December the 11th, on our Sunday night Building Zion conference call. I've got 8 quotes that I want to share with you. Half of them are from recent years, and the first half are from the old days, back in the 1870s. And again, just briefly, I went through all the conference talks. BYU has a database back to 1849 or so of all the conference talks, and I went through them all looking for quotes that mention building Zion or establishing Zion or some form of those phrases, and found over 500 quotes. And all this series of calls, we've talked about the various subcategories that these 500 quotes fell into. So tonight, the short version of this category, I call it, it's up to us. So in other words, we can take the initiative to build Zion. And so anyway, let me read the first quote here. My favorite among these is actually a 2002 quote by a member of the 70, Keith B. McMullen, in his October 2002 conference call talk. But we'll go ahead and go back and give Brigham a chance. So this is from April 1870. And basically he says, we have to be willing to build Zion. And I think that should be obvious, but let me read his quote. I think I've actually read this one on a different category, but it fits here too. Are we prepared now to establish the Zion that the Lord designs to build up? I have many times asked the questions, where is the man that knows how to lay the first rock for the wall that is to surround the New Jerusalem or the Zion of God on earth? Where is the man who knows how to construct the first gate of the city? Where is the man who understands how to build up the kingdom of God in its purity and prepare Zion to come down to meet it? Well, says one, I thought the Lord was going to do this. So he is, if we will let him. That is what we want. We want the people to be willing for the Lord to do it. But he will do it by means. He will not send angels to gather up the rock to build up the New Jerusalem. He will not send his angels from the heavens to go to the mountains to cut the timber and make it into lumber to adorn the city of Zion. He has called upon us to do this work, and if we will let him work by, through, and with us, we can accomplish it. Love that quote.
I love that quote.
That's a good one. So he, you know, clearly we have to be willing to work with the Lord to bring it about. And he's specifically talking about the New Jerusalem, but I'm pretty sure that would apply to any manifestation of Zion.
Absolutely. It actually reminds me of something my dad told me when I was little. I was sick and I hated taking medicine. So I was crying, please give me a blessing. I know if you give me a blessing, I'll be better. And I truly did have complete faith that would happen. But my dad said, no, God doesn't work that way. You have to prepare your body and do your part.
Do your part, yeah.
Yeah. And I've learned through the years that while you absolutely can be healed purely by faith.
Jesus did that, it.
Yeah. That you have to take it to God and say, I have the faith to be healed. How
what do you want me to do?
Do you want me to be healed?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that formula applies here too. If
exactly.
This next quote was from Wilford Woodruff 3 years later, 1873, and I summarized it: God will replace us if we don't build Zion. Oops. I guess that summary doesn't really fit the category, but I think the quote does. Let me read it. Mm-hmm. The Lord has had Zion before his face from before the foundation of the world, and he's going to build it up. The work is in our hands to perform. The God of heaven requires it of us. And if we fail to build it up, we shall be under condemnation. and the Lord would remove us out of the way, and he would raise up another people who would do it. Why? Because the Almighty has decreed that this work shall be performed on the earth, and no power on hell or earth can hinder it. Now that I think about it, this quote doesn't really fit in this category. It's a great quote, but let's see. We can take the initiative to build up Zion. It's up to us. Well, he's basically saying if we don't do it, someone else will. What's that?
Just that it emphasizes how important it is that we do it. If we want to be a part of it, we have to do the work and not wait around.
Yeah, for someone else.
Yep.
This next quote was,
move on without us.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. This next quote is by Apostle Daniel Wells, 1878. So this was after Brigham died. Why could, and I subtitled it, God Waits on Us. Why could not we establish the united order among the people? Because we did not know how to do so. And I have not seen a man who knew how, and for the reason that we were not prepared to receive it. When the Lord finds he has a people who will not give them over to the devil and waste them, then he will bestow the eternal riches. But this will not be done and cannot be done consistently until he has a people who will use them for the glory of his kingdom. So he's basically saying, well, in fact, I didn't read the whole quote. The first part of the quote says, the Lord's going to, you know, until we proper, in fact, let me just read it. Until we know how to properly accomplish and apply all these things, the Lord will never hand over to us the riches of the earth. As it is, we have not sufficient of the Spirit of the Lord to entitle us to this great blessing. As soon as he finds out he has got a people who will hold what he gives, he will bestow it. And when he knows that they will apply it to his glory. And then he says, why could we not establish a united order? Because we didn't know how, and we weren't able to receive it. So I guess we need to be good stewards of what the Lord has given us already, and basically, he's saying we've got to convince the Lord that we're serious.
Absolutely.
I guess that's what he's saying. So those were three quotes from the 1870s. I have to admit, I haven't looked between then and 2002, but the next quote is just a few years. The next quote is one of my favorites from a member of the 70, Keith McMullen. And, of course, he's not a prophet or an apostle, but, you know, still.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, here we go. The establishment of Zion should be the aim of every member of this church. And quote, and the Lord called his people Zion because they were of one heart and one mind and dwelt in righteousness, and there was no poor among them. Take special note of the word because in the scripture. Zion is established and flourishes because of the God-inspired lives and labors of its citizens. Zion comes not as a gift, but because virtuous covenant people are drawn together and build it.
Mm-hmm. It's the end product.
Yeah. It's kind of the stamp of approval. God says, okay, you guys qualify. Bink, Zion.
Yep.
I love that quote. Zion comes not as a gift. So in other words, God isn't just going to show up and say, here you go. But because virtuous covenant people are drawn together and build it. I hope that's what we're doing.
Yeah, well, it's like the scripture says, it's, you know, blessings are predicated upon the principles. It's line upon line, and that we have to be living the principles that build Zion.
Right.
And really, we build it. And God just helps and supports that.
Yeah, inspires us, fills in the blanks, all of that stuff.
Yeah.
Another member of the 70, David R. Stone, gave a talk. It was a really great talk. I love his talk. Let me look up the name of it really quick. Okay, I've got it bookmarked right here. David R. Stone, Zion in the Midst of Babylon. It's a great talk. He talks about your favorite city, Las Vegas, but he doesn't come out and say that's what he's talking about, but it's pretty obvious when you read it. He's talking about, you know, Babylon. Anyway,
mm-hmm.
So David R. Stone, April 2006, he says, and it's a very short quote, "We can live as a Zion people if we wish to." That's it. In fact, you know, now that I think of it, there's a quote by Brigham that basically says, I don't know why I don't have it here on this page. He basically says that we can have Zion as soon as we, is the people,
want
what
it?
Was the word he uses? Conclude to make it.
Mm-hmm.
All we got to do is decide.
A lot of things in life work that way.
Yeah.
Yep.
In fact,
I actually met my husband the day that I said, okay, I'm ready to meet my soulmate. It's true.
Okay, I've got to find this quote by Brigham. It's, take me a second, hang on here. Search the database. Ah, shoot. Okay, couldn't find it right away. Anyway, yeah, basically Brigham said, all we have to do is decide and we can do it. So from Elder Stone's same talk, he said, wherever we are, whatever city we may live in, we can build our own Zion by the principles of the celestial kingdom. And, let's see, did I read that right? We can build our own Zion by the principles of the celestial kingdom and ever seek to become the pure in heart. I wonder if he left a word out. I skipped one. This is Bonnie Parkin, October 2004 conference. And my little side note was, it's building Zion is still the goal. Now, I have a note to myself here on this quote. She could be operating under the definition that Zion is the church, which I think, what's his name, started that way back in the 1870s. Anyway, I'll read the quote. President Joseph F. Smith issued a charge that we, quote, take hold of this work of Relief Society with vigor, with intelligence, and unitedly for the building up of Zion. If we believe that the Lord's church has been restored, and we do, this is her, then we must believe that the Relief Society is an essential part of his organizational fold. We need to stop asking whether we fit, because we do. Our differences are not so great that we cannot build Zion together. So at least she's using the language of, you know, saying that we're still interested in building up Zion. In her mind, I don't know, but in her mind, she may be thinking Zion is the church, which a lot of members still believe that.
Yeah.
But obviously, David R. Stone doesn't believe that, because he says we can live as a Zion people if we wish to. Well, the other side of that is we aren't living as a Zion people because we don't want to.
Yeah.
You know, the corresponding concept is that we aren't living as a Zion people.
Living as a Zion people is not easy.
No. Well, it's especially if we don't live in that kind of culture. Our culture
exactly.
is diametrically opposed to that.
Well, and honestly, I really think that our culture is moving much more toward being being able to be a Zion people than we were back in Brigham Young's time. I mean, Young's time, they truly believed in a hierarchy of people. You know, there were people that were closer
Less
to God and better and... Yeah.
Sure. Well, and you, as Babylon, you know, this split in the last prophesied in the last days between the righteous and the wicked, is as Babylon gets more wicked, people are going, wait a minute, society shouldn't be like that. We shouldn't be doing that, mm-hmm. you know. And you and I have talked about we've talked on this call before about how both the Occupy Wall Street people and the Tea Party people are both saying, wait a minute, we shouldn't have wealthy people running our government.
Certainly not the way that they are running it.
What's that?
Certainly not the way that they are running it.
Right. And so I think the more Babylon's decay manifests and the closer we get to its collapse, people are going to be saying, wait a minute. We shouldn't be living this way. And I'm going to be over on the sidelines saying, yes, you're right. Let's build Zion instead. Why wait? So anyway, the last quote I have is from Henry B. Eyring, October 2009, and he's basically saying, we just need the determination. In the terrible days of persecution and deprivation, as the faithful moved from Ohio to Missouri to Illinois and then across the deserts going west, the sisters in their poverty and sorrows cared for others. You would weep, as I did, if I now read to you some of the accounts in your history. Their determination, born of faith, to serve the Lord and others, seemed to take them not around the storms of life, but directly into them. Some were young and some were old. They were from many lands and peoples, as you are today, but they were of one heart, one mind, and with one intention. What does that sound like? They were determined to help the Lord build his Zion, where there could be the happy existence the Book of Mormon had described so vividly for them. Yesterday in the temple, I reread 4th Nephi. I was thinking about including some of those verses in my persuasive essay that I wrote.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, I was reading through 4th Nephi, and it definitely describes a very happy existence when the people were living in a Zion society that Christ had blessed them with. And, it describes all the elements. They had no poor among them, not because they kicked them out. Which I wonder if some saints think that's how you end up with no poor, is you kick them out.
yes. I could give a whole lecture on that one.
and I don't believe Zion is going to be brought about through leveling, meaning the rich people are stolen from and given to the poor people.
Mm-hmm.
I believe the no poor comes from the fact that there are no rich and no poor. In my persuasive essay, I gave you a copy, Andrea.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I talk about how Brigham noticed that the merchants in Salt Lake City were starting to create their own elite class because they were getting super wealthy off buying products back east and selling them in Salt Lake. And, they would buy fancy carriages and jewelry and nice clothing. And there started to be this division into classes. And he said, no, we're not doing this. Sorry. Bzzzt. Wrong answer. And, in fact, the 4th Nephi talks about the fact that they were divided into classes. Once people started not having all things common among them, and I believe that meant resources. So, for example, Hugh Nibley's father or grandfather, I think, made all his money by cutting down the redwood forests in California and selling the wood, you know, claiming ownership to the resources that God gave everyone. And I believe that's what all things common means, is all the resources belong to all of us. And
absolutely.
and we developed them for our mutual benefit. In Jacob, too, I reread that chapter with the idea in mind of trying to understand what God would want for his people as far as an economy goes. And Jacob, too, is visited by an angel and says, I want you to go call the people to repentance because they're doing these two very wicked things. And the one, everybody remembers, is they were doing the concubine thing, having multiple wives and stuff. But the other thing they were doing was claiming common resources for their own. So you had some Nephites who went out mining and found gold, and they said, this is our gold. This is my gold.
Yep.
I found it. I worked hard for it. And they went, apparently, and hired people to make them nice clothes. And they didn't share the gold with the rest of the community. It occurred to me what the angel called this iniquity. And you, if you read Jacob 2 with that idea in mind, it'll jump right off the page at you.
I actually love that that section, because it really brought to mind for me about how, you know, why do we even value rocks, basically, above things that we actually need, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And the reality is when you are starving, you don't.
Yeah.
And so clearly they had gotten to a point where everyone was doing really pretty well.
Uh-huh.
Everyone was comfortable. And so all of a sudden gold and rocks became
nice
more valuable because they're pretty. They're a nice addition. They're an extra.
Yeah.
But we only value them that highly when they're extra. You know, when money wasn't worth very much, it started getting burned as kindling. When, you know, because that's what becomes more important and more valued.
Well, you know, that's interesting that you've mentioned that, because now that I think of it, the saints in Salt Lake City did the same thing. When they first got to Salt Lake, they acted as one family. They divided up into committees. One committee went hunting. One committee went fishing. One committee went to cut down logs. One committee stayed in camp and built homes. They had like 9 or 10 committees, and everyone worked together in the little Zion community. They were one heart and one mind. Let's survive here.
Yeah.
And then once survival was guaranteed, then we start dividing up. Well, this is mine. You know, you can't have it, kind of thing.
Yep.
And
well, because there's extra, and all of a sudden, well, why should I give this little bit of extra, this little bit
right.
of comfort that I worked for
right.
to somebody else? Why should I share it? Yeah.
So when we get our own little Zion community, we'll need to figure out how to overcome that. Because it also crops up in, I think it's the Book of Mosiah. I can't remember. I'm pretty sure it's early in the Book of Mosiah that he talked about how, you know, the saints were prospering because they were united, having all things common. And then after a while, they got prospered, and then, you know, then they broke away and did their own thing, and then they got wicked. Same thing happened in 4th Nephi. So apparently, when abundance happens, we struggle to stay united as a people, as humans.
Absolutely.
I guess that's the natural.
Well, and it's also when we take the doctrines that God has taught us and the Spirit has taught us and twist them to our own convenience. I can give some examples, like
please.
I think a great example is the doctrine that, and it's a true doctrine, I certainly believe it, that, you know, God places us exactly where we need to be, according to, you know, part of it's because of what happened in the pre-existence and things like that. But we can twist that into, well, just like the Jews did, this person was born blind because of some sin. And so they don't deserve to be treated as well as the rest of us.
Or we're better than those people.
Who are we to step in? We don't have that, yeah. And it happens all the time. I see it and I watch it all the time. People saying, well, who am I? Who am I to you know, mess with what the circumstances that God gave them? If they were born this way or if they're poor, that's their own fault.
Yeah.
But, you know, it couldn't possibly be because, you know, they were put in that position for me to help them, for me to care about them and lift them up.
Well, if you're born into a society that can have rich and poor, then you're going to either be rich or poor.
Yeah.
If you're born into a society that rich and poor doesn't exist because it's not possible to be rich or poor, then you won't be either. So it doesn't make sense to blame somebody for being poor. You know, our market economy is based on the better you are at selling people and buying stuff, the better you're going to prosper in a market economy.
And in often cases, the better you are at manipulating people into thinking that they need what you have.
Isn't that the same thing?
Yeah. I mean, there's whole books and courses on teaching that. Well, my dad was a salesman.
So. Okay.
And he'd still agree with me.
Yeah. So, yeah, if you happen to particularly stink at being at functioning in a market economy, then you're going to end up poor. And that doesn't mean you're a bad person and that God doesn't love you and that you don't have value and that your needs aren't important. It just means you don't have that gift or that talent. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, society tends to pick and choose what is of value and who is of value.
Yeah.
But God does not.
Yep.
God doesn't.
In fact, he says that
instead,
in Jacob 2, doesn't he? Yeah.
Yeah.
I esteem all flesh as one or something like that.
Yeah. We all have equal value and it's infinite. There is no end or lack to our value. Anyone. I have a friend who, she had a son who was born without a brain. He was never ever going to make it to adulthood. He was never going to be able to be a financially contributing member of society.
Right.
And he was absolutely only ever going to be a drain financially and in all resources as far as that goes. But was he in any way lacking in worth? And in the value that he could truly bring to his community, he wasn't.
Hmm.
And neither is anyone
else.
It doesn't
make sense to condemn him for not being good at it.
Yep.
And,
you know, they're not necessarily meant to be good at it. Or maybe they were meant not to be good at it so that you could mentor them and they become good at it. Some, you know. That our job isn't to judge someone's worth. Our job is to say, here are my hands. What would you have me do?
Hmm.
How can I be of help? How can I be of service? And how can I love?
Which is the exact opposite of what Jacob was preaching against. I love this verse 13 in Jacob 2, and the hand of providence hath smiled upon you most pleasingly, that you have obtained many riches, and because some of you have obtained more abundantly than that of your brethren, because they weren't sharing, Ye are lifted up in the pride of your hearts, and wear stiff necks and high heads because of the costliness of your apparel, and persecute your brethren because ye suppose that ye are better than they. That's the root cause of all pride, which destroys Zion, is supposing that you're better than another person for whatever reason. Doesn't matter what the reason is.
No.
So all we have to do is conquer pride and ta-da! Ready, go.
Yep.
So anyway.
And really, well, I mean, in some ways our society has grown a lot from that. We've gotten a lot better at saying, hey, just because you're different from me, I can still recognize your worth. I can still recognize your value, and I can stand up for you.
Yeah. Yep. So Joyce couldn't make the call today, but I know she would want us to talk about, okay, what can we do now? What can we do today? What can our listeners do? You know, not everybody's going to be interested in our project. So if you're new to the call, those of us involved on a regular basis in the calls are interested in following Lorenzo Snow's example of what he did in Brigham City in the 1860s and 70s. And they created a network of cooperatives, and everyone in town worked in one of the cooperatives. And when an international recession hit, they didn't even notice because they were producing all their own consumer goods, most of their own, 85% of their own consumer goods locally. And they didn't care that the banks were struggling. Didn't matter to them. So it makes sense that we pick up where the early saints left off, and of our own free will and choice, in an attempt to bring to pass much righteousness. For the power is within us. We are agents unto ourselves. We feel like this would be a good approach to start preparing ourselves. You know, practice makes perfect. Let's get some practice in building Zion before we have to do the real thing. So if you're not interested in doing that with us, how can, you know, I'm asking you and me both, Andrea and Barry, how can Average Joe Mormon help build Zion? How can they prepare themselves?
For me, I do think it really does start in your heart. Yeah. You know, and it comes down to that whole really at the core of your being, understanding and then taking that understanding that every single soul is literally as good and valuable and loved by God as you are, regardless of their circumstances. And then
he would want them to have their needs met.
Exactly.
Of course, he would want them to contribute as much as they could or capable of. You know, Bruce is listening. Let me share, he shared on the Facebook page. Let me share what he wrote. He said, the telestial attitude says, I am better than you. The terrestrial attitude says, you are just as good as I am, and I am just as good as you. I'm not sure I agree, Bruce, but I think that's the celestial one. But, you know, we can argue details later. And then he says, celestial attitude is, you are better than I. He would be, and so he's quoting Christ, he who would be the greatest of all shall be the servant of all. I definitely agree with that statement.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I struggle with the you are better than I is, if you read Ezra Taft Benson's talk, Beware of Pride, he says there's two sides to pride. There's the one side that says, I'm better than you, and then there's the other side that says, you're better than me. I really do think the you are just as good as I am, and I am just as good as you, is the celestial attitude. I could be wrong, Bruce.
I think it depends on how, I think it depends on how you mean it, because there's the people who mean it as, because I do not have worth, because I need to get my worth from you, because you are better than me, I need to get my worth from you. And so I have to do these things, and if I don't get the responses I want, the appreciation or whatever, then I'm going to resent you. And it becomes this conditional,
and
relationship. Whereas if instead it's the relationship of, I'm not exactly sure the best way to word it, but because I wouldn't necessarily say that it's that they're better, but it's, I am first here to serve you, and serving you will in turn serve me. And not worrying about how someone is there to serve you. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'm happy to do my part for the benefit of the group, kind of thing.
Exactly, because the telestial is, I'm happy to serve as long as I know you're going to serve the same amount. As long as it's tit for tat, I'm happy. But the celestial is, no, I'm just happy to serve. And just the serving will be its own reward. I don't need you to,
You've been on a really important point here, and that is, if our self-worth is external to us, if we're depending on other people's pats on our back and praise and good job, then how can we be equals?
Yeah.
Our self-worth has to come from God. It has to be in our hearts that we are valuable, that God loves us no matter what. I have an acquaintance who I mentioned once, if you sat on a stump in the backyard for days, you would have just as much value as if you went out and did whatever. Value, you're inherently value as you are. You don't have to prove your value. You don't have to earn your value. You are valuable. And that, I think that's what you and I are saying, is that we all have that inherent value, whether we believe we do or not.
Is what inherent, what it means. Our value, our worth is not in any way conditional. It never has been, it never will be. And when we operate from that paradigm of conditional, then we're always going to screw it up every single time. One way or the other, we're going to swing the pendulum either too far in, I'm not worthy and I have to do all of these things to prove that I have any value, or I'm better than everybody else. I don't have to do anything. You
anything.
Deserve me. Right. Either way is wrong. But when you really, truly understand that you and everyone around you is of infinite worth, period. The fact that you exist is all the proof you need.
Yeah.
Then it becomes easy.
And it makes sense that you would have to have that mentality in order to function in a Zion society. Mm-hmm. You can't be trying to prove your worth. I don't see how that could work. If I'm running around trying to prove my worth to everyone, I'm going to I'm going to take offense when somebody doesn't act the way I think they should towards me, or I can't see how it could possibly work. So back to the question. Getting rid of pride obviously is the best thing anybody could do to prepare to live in a Zion society. What else?
I don't know. I think it starts with your heart. And then, also really turning to God, if listening to the spirit of, and you know, having that spirit of, how can I serve?
Yeah. And, you know, Bruce just posted, and so it's essentially agreeing with what you just said. He quotes Christ, "I came not to do my own will, but of him who sent me." That is so crucial, to be able to learn how to do God's will in your life. I happen to know you and I both have stories about how the Lord told us to do something we didn't want to do.
Yeah.
And we did it, and our lives were greatly blessed for it. Those are the people we need to be able to build a Zion community, is people who can connect with God, who can discern what his will is for them, and who will do it.
You have to test that, you know, following the Spirit. You have to keep trying it. Every time you feel that you get a prompting, you have to follow and learn from that experience stuff. Because if Nephi hadn't had such a close relationship with God and such good practice, I mean, he doesn't say that he had practiced following the promptings of the Spirit, but he must have, because you don't get a prompting to slay Laban and go, "Oh, well, okay." You know, I mean, of course he still struggled with it, but it wasn't this couldn't be the Spirit. This couldn't be God. It was a, "Are you sure? I just want to make sure that I'm clear on this," because he knew that was the Spirit. He knew exactly who was talking to him. And it's, you know, I've had similar experiences where I wanted to go on a mission, and I started praying, and I kept getting the answer, "No, that's not what you're supposed to do." And I was like, "Are you kidding me? How could that be the answer? That's completely contrary to what I've been taught, that, you know, mission is so good and so important, and it's bringing people into the gospel, and if you're not, you know, getting married, whatever, then you should serve a mission." And it wasn't until I got the answer, "Well, I told you what I want, now you do whatever you want," that I went, "Okay, never mind."
Yeah, never mind. You know why never mind? Because if you do something you want to do that God tells you not to, it will not work out.
Exactly. And I already knew that one. So I was like, "Okay, I know the lesson that comes after that one, that answer, so I'm done. Never mind. Yeah. I will do whatever you want."
And I suppose that might be an important issue to share with listeners, is learning how to hear the Lord's will for you is risky.
Yeah, and scary.
You know, when Joseph connected with God, Lucifer came, tried to come in between him. Same thing happened to Moses. On a much lesser scale, the same thing happened to me. The same thing, if I remember correctly, happened to Barry, who's listening. Hi, Barry. And you have to learn to discern, is this the Lord's spirit talking to me, or is it a deceptive spirit? Usually, in my limited experience, and I can only talk from my experience, once you figure it out the first time, you're pretty much clear after that. But years ago, I was teaching people how to get answers to prayers. I wrote this article on how to do it. And I met a gal later I had taught this to. And she apparently didn't figure out the deception part, because she... And, you know, maybe it's the Lord's will that she moved to Manti and become a polygamist wife. I don't know. But my guess is that wasn't the Lord's will, and that she had been deceived. So you have to...
It depends on what she went to the Lord asking to learn.
Yeah. That's true. That's a good point. Yeah, if you want to... Yeah. Yeah, that could be. So... Anyway, I would just counsel anyone who's new to the process of actually getting answers to, you know, to double check. Here's the big one. Don't assume the Lord means right now when he tells you to do something.
Yeah.
We jump to that conclusion, and it may not be right now. You have to remember, he's not on our linear timeline. He's seeing everything all at once, right? So if he tells you, you know, you need to do something, it doesn't necessarily mean right now. And, yeah. So watch for false spirits.
Really, when the right now doesn't happen, there's always a reason. And so that, for me, is the time that I say, okay, what am I needing to learn right now that is a preparation for
what
I know is coming?
What you want me to do. Right.
Exactly. Yeah. Because it always is. It's always, it's not that it can't be right now as far as that it's impossible. It's that you aren't ready, that there are things to be put in place. And sometimes for you, the only thing is the waiting. Sometimes it's other people that need to actually be doing the work of getting ready while you just learn the lesson of trusting that it's going to happen when it's going to happen.
Yeah. Barry's made an interesting comment on Facebook about personal revelation. Let me read it. He says, I find it interesting that in today's consolidation and recombining of churches under the United Nations support and Catholic leadership, that the principle of, quote, personal revelation from God is becoming a sign of heresy. Moses had the desire that all the Lord's people were prophets and that the Lord would put his spirit upon them. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, we definitely...
Well, it's easy to take away free agency if you can't have your own personal relationship with God and get your own answers.
And that's the big check and balance for the church. You know, our U.S. government has the division into functions and levels as a check and balance. In the church, we have personal revelation as a check and balance. I had a bishop tell me to move back to Arizona because I had lost my job, and he had a perfect record of paying out no fast offering funds to help any poor people in our ward, and I was the first. And so I ruined his good record, and he wanted me to move out of the ward.
That's not a good record.
And
that's not a good record to have.
Yeah, sorry, buddy. I'm pretty sure that wasn't an inspired bit of counsel. So we have, you know, the check and balance has to be there. God's not going to expect us to be blindly obedient. And if he does value us all equally, there's no reason why he should not reveal his will to us individually. It makes perfect sense.
Absolutely.
Well, so, you and I need to get back to our spouses, Andrea.
Yes.
And it's 8:00 just about. So, let's see. So, I've only got one more category of quotes. And the only reason I created this category was because there was a good brother in our ward before they cut our ward into pieces that every time anyone brought up the fact that our stake president wanted us to build Zion in our stake, he would say, and I quote, "We can't build Zion. Only God can build Zion." Or Jesus, he would say, "Only Jesus can build Zion." And technically he's right. You know, God needs to be part of that process. We have to rely on his direction and his wisdom. But the attitude the message that I was getting from him is, let's just sit back and enjoy Babylon and we'll wait for God to do all the work. And I'm just thinking, no, sorry.
Yep.
I can't do that. So anyway,
well, he must have missed what the message for the city of Enoch was, because they, the city of Enoch happened because of their work and what they did. It wasn't God like coming in and saying, by the way, I've chosen your city.
Right.
That you're now going to do this. Yeah. And here's the plan.
Right.
Here's how you're supposed to do it.
Right. Again, you know, again, I say to this brother, reading Brother McMullen's quote, Zion comes not as a gift, but because mm-hmm. virtuous covenant people are drawn together and build it. Anyway,
absolutely.
So next week will be the last time I share quotes like this, and I've titled it On the Theory That Only Jesus Can Build Zion, We Can't. And there's a few quotes from the 1800s. Anyway, so thank you everyone for joining the call. Thank you, Andrea, for co-hosting today. And
thank you, Jesse.
I guess we'll see everybody next year in the New Jerusalem, right?
Or as close as we can come to it for today.
Right. Okay. Thanks, everyone. Good night.
Thanks, Jesse. Good night.